Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in 040514, State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company versus Jimmy R. Norris.
May it please the court, Mr. Staines will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner will reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, two of the issues in this underinsured motorist case are pre-judgment interest and attorney's fees. However, in my opinion, the dispositive issue in this case is how you apply the credits to which the insurance company is entitled. In this case, the jury found actual damages $51,200. It was stipulated, no dispute, that the insurance company was entitled to credits in the amount of $55,000 more than the damages. And the trial court properly rendered a take-nothing judgment. So the question is, how do you apply the credits? Do you apply them first, then calculate prejudgment interest, or do you calculate prejudgment interest first? We think the jurisprudence of this state and all other situations is that you apply the credits first. First, the prejudgment interest statutes provide that prejudgment interest is calculated or based on the judgment, not on the verdict. And you arrive at a judgment after applying the credits. There are several cases that hold consistent with the statute, including the Sisters of Charity versus Dunsmore case, an Austin Court of Appeals case, a recent case, Pringle versus Moon out of Fort Worth 2 months ago, and the other cases cited in our brief. And if you don't do that, if you apply or calculate prejudgment interest first, you are basically allowing a double recovery for the plaintiff insured. In this case, State Farm received a credit of $50,000 for the limit of the tortfeasor's policy, and also another $5,000 credit for PIP payments that were previously made. The insured was deemed to have received those right after the accident, and in fact received most of those. So if you award prejudgment interest on that, you're awarding money for something that they did not lose. That's a double recovery.
Well, no, money for something they've already been paid for. The double recovery is the use of the money. They've had the use of the money from the tortfeasor's policy, and they're getting it again.
Yes, Your Honor. Also, to apply the credits first is consistent with this court's decision in Strassner, which says the credit is applied and deducted from the amount of actual damages. So we think that's the dispositive issue in this case, and the trial court ruled properly.
We have the overlay of the insurance code here as well. Assuming we decide that you do apply credits first, should we take into account the actual timing of the credits?
I don't believe so. First of all, it's clear that the insurance company gets a credit for the amount of the tortfeasor's policy. And that's even the case if the insured settles for less than the limit. A lot of times an insured will settle for less than the limit and take their chances against the insurance company's trial because they got an insurance company defendant. But they're deemed, since we have the credit, we're deemed to have received that from the very beginning. That's a practical rule. It's easy to calculate. It's easy to apply. Otherwise, if you look at the timing of the settlement or when they actually settled with the tortfeasor, it's kind of chaos in trying to determine how much prejudgment interest is.
What if there's a delay in the time that PIP benefits are paid? Should you take that into account?
Usually not, because ordinarily, when the bills are submitted to the carrier pays. If they don't, you have another claim for unreasonable withholding of PIP benefits under other provisions of the insurance code. A second issue in this case, and I'm going to follow up the argument in the first case, is attorney's fees. I noticed there were a lot of questions about valid claim and legal entitlement and things of that nature. I think that this underinsured motorist provision under the insurance contract is a hybrid of tort and contract. We got mental anguish and pain and suffering. But I think the right result, which is very consistent with Henson, that there's no legal entitlement to the benefit until liability has been established. Reasonable minds can differ, like any other tort case. And especially for intangible damages such as pain and suffering. So I believe you have a valid claim or legal entitlement once that liability is established.
In the verdict?
I think, like any other tort case, when you have a final judgment, appeal or no appeal, when you have a final result. Now, the court used the language verdict in Henson, but I'm not sure. I think that's kind of basically dictated to the decision there. I think the correct result would be final
judgment. And why not until after resolving any appeals?
That's what I mean. That's what I mean when I say final judgment.
I thought you said appeal or not.
Well, sometimes they might appeal, sometimes they
so won't. If there's a final judgment in the trial court, but there is a notice of appeal is perfected, then you would say liability is not finally determined until the appellate resolution, down the road.
Unless in the unlikely event we have a bad faith appeal or something. That's true for any case. I mean, you have the right to appeal. The insurance company has that right as well.
And you just think we were using loose language when we said verdict in Henson?
Oh, I don't want to go that far, but I think that was not necessary to the holding of the case. A third issue in this case is prejudgment interest. And I don't think the court needs to get there in this case because of the credit issue. But in the event the court does, I think Henson ought to be applied to my case. Now, in Henson, the court held, because uninsured insurers do not breach their contractual obligation to pay until tort liability is established, we conclude that prejudgment interest begins running from the day liability of the uninsured motorist is established. So, if you take that holding in Henson, and even though it was really a different question in Henson, but they're trying to add prejudgment interest on top of the benefit. I think you should apply it to situations which the damages are less than the limit of the policy. That way you avoid the double recovery problems I mentioned before. I think it's consistent with the wording of the statute. And it's the most practical way to apply it. And so with that said, I believe the court should reverse the 10th Court of Appeals decision and that the trial court decision is a pick nothing judgment in our case with proper.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Thomas will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I'm here today. Actually, I've got issues in this case that were in the first case, the attorney's fees, and then we've got the issues of the underinsured motorists, which I guess are issues in the third case. It's been my luck if I did third, then I could have had all the benefit of hearing the questions and the arguments of the counsel in this case. However, I think clearly the issue on the prejudgment interest has already been determined. In the Henson case, I think State Farm is certainly misinterpreting that case. The key question in Henson was whether or not a insurer could get prejudgment interest on top of their policy limits. If you look at the language of the statute, the language of the policy, State Farm is entitled to pay all damages that Jimmy Norris was legally entitled to recover from the operator of an underinsured motorist. It doesn't say all actual damages. It doesn't say liquidated damages. It says all damages legally entitled to recover. Well, it's been clear in Texas law that a person who is injured, you get the Kavanaugh type. And we do have a blended case here because it's a contract case with tort issues involved. But the injured person's damages include prejudgment interest. That was decided in Kavner, and in the finance code says all judgments shall include prejudgment interest. So in this case, his damages were determined by the verdict of actual damages of $51,200 before you calculate credits or anything. But state, had Mr. Norris gone, that judgment then against Mr. Johnston, the tortfeasor, he would have gotten the verdict for the $25,000 past pain and suffering and mental anguish, that was about $13 each on impairment and past medical expenses. If that would have been against the tortfeasor, then his damages would clearly have included pre-judgment interest. That's what you under
Can we talk about the crediting?
Pardon?
Can we talk about the crediting for a moment?
Sure.
If, let's say you'd proceeded to trial against Mr. Norris and he had tendered his policy limits, $25,000, but you thought he had some more, you had an opportunity to get a judgment against him. The judgment that would have been entered against Mr. Norris would have taken into account the $25,000 credit before it calculated prejudgment interest, wouldn't it have?
I'm not sure if I followed the question, but I think you still determine his amount of his damages.
Well, let's look at the suit against Mr. Norris.
Mr. Norris is the
Mr. Norris is sued against the tortfeasor.
Uh-huh.
The tortfeasor tenders his $25,000 limits
right.
up front.
Right.
And Mr. Norris says, I think you're worth more than that, and I'm going to go ahead and get a judgment against you. So you go ahead and get a judgment against the tortfeasor. That judgment would have credited the $25,000 before it calculated prejudgment interest on the damages.
I think so, and I think that in your question to previous counsel about the timing, I think that probably is something that needs to be decided is when were these payments made to the injured party. Mr. Norris, did he get the $25,000 a week after the wreck? Or did he get, actually it was more than that. Or did he get it after he had to go to lawsuit, et cetera, and wait 4 years? So I think you still do look at the timing of when the payments are made. But first, the key question under any UIM policy and underinsured motorist policy is what is the injured party's damages? You get that question first. And that damages have to include prejudgment interest because of Kavanaugh, the finance code, etc. And then if you look at the contract, it says then any payment that they have made on PIP, and that's the part that if I'd gotten $56,000, I wouldn't be having this problem because I'd be over the $50,000 tortfeasor's limits plus the $5,000. Fortunately for me, I got in the gray window of between 50 and 55, so that's probably why we're here today. But it's then determined when the PIP payment, it's the credit. You determine his damages, and then you do the offsets, and that's when you get the offset, and the damages have to include prejudgment interest. That's clearly the law. If you're going to say from now on, an underinsured motorist is not going to be entitled to prejudgment interest, then we're really changing what injured parties are entitled to recover by law, and that's what this contract says. We're going to pay you. State Farm sold Mr. Norris a policy. It says we're going to pay you all the damages you're legally entitled to recover because of an underinsured motorist. And then it says the PIP language, any payment made shall be applied toward a settlement or judgment that person receives under the coverage. Well, that's what he did. He got the judgment, the verdict, which it should have included, the verdicts from the jury and the trial court should have added what was required by law, the prejudgment interest, and then State Farm gets its credits. Because any payment shall be applied towards the settlement or judgment that person receives. So I think you have to foresee that this judgment was against Mr. Johnston, the tortfeasor, that would obviously include prejudgment interest. We're not here trying to get more than our underinsured motorist, which was what was doing in Henson's case. And I think that's what, even in this Henson case, this court stated, and the insurers did not dispute that had the trial court awarded prejudgment interest against the tort defendants, the insurers would be obligated to pay the entire judgment, including that portion awarded for prejudgment interest, to the extent of policy limits. That's what I'm asking this court to do, is to have State Farm pay the judgment that was the verdict of damages against Mr. Johnson, the tort defeasor. The insurer would be obligated to pay the entire judgment, including that portion for prejudgment interest, included up to the policy limits. And I think that's in Henson. And in the Henson case, when they said, well, you just don't get prejudgment interest in the UIM cases, that's when you're trying to get more than the policy. And in this case, what happened in the Henson case, the trial court, there was damages at $133,842. That was more than the $20,000 for the tort feeser, and State Farm immediately gave the $45,000. And the Henson defendant, Henson plaintiff, was wanting, no, you owe me prejudgment interest on top of that $45,000 of that underinsured motorist limits. He was thinking more to the extent the policy provided. So I think that's where we're different. I think the question is, it's clearly, you get, and actually in the Nickerson case, which was the first case, that case was actual damages plus prejudgment interest, less offsets, exceed the policy limits of $300,000. Well, in this case, Mr. Norris was clearly injured by an underinsured driver. His damages were $51,200 before any prejudgment interest. If the tortfeasor was $50,000, he's underinsured. Let's give him his prejudgment interest, then we'll give him his credits, give State Farm any credits that they're to which they're legally entitled to. And I do think probably the timing of those should be considered in calculating the judgment, which a trial court will easily do after a jury verdict is heard. I don't think this is double recovery. What if this, I mean, we always use this court, all the courts use uninsured motorists and uninsured motorists the same. Well, if this had been an uninsured motorist, Mr. Norris would have clearly been able to go ahead and sue the uninsured motorist, get all of his damages, including prejudgment interest, and then have the credit. Then there's no credit, but he would get his prejudgment interest. And he didn't have any money at all in his pocket. It's just not a double recovery. With respect to the second issue, and I think also the Minix case in which this court denied the petition for review, the insured was entitled to pay prejudgment interest to the extent it did not exceed policy UIM policy limit. So all Mr. Norris is requesting this court to do is follow that language that's in the Henson case and as well as by denying the review in the Minix case. Attorney's fees, the first case, I guess it was State Farm versus Nickerson, so it was the State Farm's attorney said, well, they've got a statutory remedy. That doesn't mean that's the only remedy I have. Insured people are just like anybody else. They go out and buy a contract, and they have a contract. And if I want to pursue my attorney's fees under contract rather than going to 2155 or the insurance code, rather than going to some statutory, State Farm Insurance Company should mandate what theory of recovery that an insured person is going to seek. I think this is just like any other contract case. All contracts have a gray area. There's a gray area. Most of the parties usually disagree as to whether or not there's even been a breach. And I know Justice Brister, I believe, had asked about, you know, unliquidated damages. But I think even in a contractual case, although you don't really have the pure pain and suffering mental anguish, I took about a breach of a business case where there's loss of profits. That's always a gray area. I mean, it's always up to the jury to decide. And I think that...
No. Lost profits, you've got to have a track record or something close to it.
That's
so we can calculate it pretty precisely. You can't just give your opinion. I think I'm going to get...
Well, I don't mean
I think
exactly,
I'm going to make millions.
But there's usually expert opinions. 4 or 5 or 6 people can get up there, and the jury usually comes in.
Well, they've got to have some faith. There's no expert on mental anguish.
Right.
And in fact, there's no way to say what the right answer is except what a jury finds it to be.
That's true. Unfortunately, in contract cases, too, when you submit your proof, the other party doesn't always apply.
But it is the case. It is the result of your argument. When an insurer guesses what the mental anguish damages are going to be, if that's below what the jury ultimately decides, the insurance company has to pay attorney's fees. If it's above what the jury ultimately decides, the insurer doesn't have to pay attorney's fees. So it's a one-way ratchet.
Well, I respectfully disagree. I don't think when you normally do that, you attribute certain amounts to different elements.
When your client's not offering to pay attorney's fees, if it turns, if, you know, if this was before trial and they had offered $60,000, so no, I'm entitled to, you know, if your policy was bigger, no, I'm entitled to $80,000. If the jury comes back and says pay $60,000, insurance not going to pay any attorney's fees because they wasted going to this trial.
I guess they wouldn't be unless State Farm countersued and bore attorney's fees based on the contract theory. But they
haven't breached the contract. They don't have to pay anything.
Well, that's true. And you know what's key in these cases is the insurance code. It's the insurance company's burden to prove that they're uninsured. So all of this, in this case, and I think it has to be facts specific, and I think if a jury awards attorney's fees, it should be. In this case, we had State Farm, who just took the position, you know, he's not injured. He's just complaining about nothing. It's a low-impact case. He didn't get injured. Well, we had records from 3 and 4 doctors, orthopedics, 2 neurosurgeons, physical therapists, and all State Farm did was present a claims manager with a marketing degree and said, well, we just don't think he's hurt.
Did you bring a bad faith claim as well?
No, I didn't.
If you would have, you would have one. If in fact it was that clear to a reasonable insurer, you would have one, right?
I could possibly do that, and that would be another statutory right. But I still think Chapter 38 that this contract is no different than any other contract. And I think if we say no, we're going to have a determination and a judgment and a verdict, and then if they don't pay, then you can come back and sue for attorney's fees. We could possibly have 3 lawsuits stemming from one case, one against the tortfeasor, one against the uninsured carrier, and then the third one. And I think it's just a fact-specific situation that if the, you know, the jury doesn't think the attorney's fees should be awarded, they don't award them. In this case, they saw State Farm get up with a claims manager that had nothing to support his opinion other than, well, I just don't agree with what Dr. Becker and Dr. Lewin said. And I think in that incident, they saw a breach of contract and award Mr. Norris his attorney's fees under Chapter 38. And I do believe that. I see my time is up. So,
are there any further questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Okay, thank you.
My first point of rebuttal is on the credit issue. How much was Mr. Norris's claim worth? The jury said it was worth $51,200. State Farm guessed right. The plaintiff lost the case. The damages were less than credit. Yet they want prejudgment interest and attorney's fees. Makes no sense.
They won on liability, though.
Yes. But their damages were less than the amount of the credit.
So they won one, lost one. You think they lose?
To win, they have to win both.
I see. They have to be 2-0 to win.
I believe so. Yeah.
Why?
Because if they come back and find $1,000 in damages and the credits are $55,000, that's a loss. And on up the line until you get to $55,000. No money is owed under the policy unless they're underinsured. This is underinsured coverage. That's what it is.
She raised an interesting question. What would the insurance company's liability, how would this work if it was an uninsured tort fees?
Well, if it was an uninsured case, there would be no credit for the tort fees or policy because there's no insurance there. And in all the cases I've handled, it's strictly a case by the plaintiff insured against the insurance company. They usually don't sue someone who doesn't have insurance because they can't pay.
Well, what are the jury issues in a totally uninsured motorist case?
The issues are, like in any pattern jury charge car wreck case, liability and damages.
And so do you owe attorney's fees in that case if it turns out they were, in fact, uninsured?
That is a different question than underinsured. It might depend, again, get the same question about valid claim and legal entitlement. Is that a different question in the uninsured case as opposed to the underinsured case?
And why is that?
I'm theorizing the question. I believe in most uninsured motorist cases I'm just going my personal experience. Ordinarily, you don't have all these issues. Is it less than the credit or not? The question is strictly, what is the value of the claim? Then we're going to offer it. In a lot of cases, the insurance company makes an offer and the plaintiff just refuses it.
But doesn't that beg the question? Isn't the question, what are the damages?
Yes.
As I understand, you have to pay the sums that the insured is legally entitled to recover as damages. The sums they're entitled to recover as damages. And I think that's if you define damages in that context, there are damages for underinsured, there are damages for uninsured. The damages should be the damages, shouldn't they?
I believe that's a good point. The statute reads damages to which they are entitled to recover because of bodily injury.
Sums which they're entitled to recover as damages. They're entitled to recover the sums.
Because of bodily injury.
And then they include the word damages in the statute.
Right. And it says, but the full reading of the statute is, damages to which they are entitled to recover because of bodily injury.
Right.
That does not mean all sum. It does not mean punitive damages. It does not mean, like against a tortfeasor, you could.
Right.
It does not mean you can cover things you haven't lost.
So we're limiting it to bodily injury.
Yes.
The question is what damages emanate from the bodily injury.
I agree.
Okay, so we have to find damages the same way in uninsured or underinsured, don't we, to be consistent?
Maybe so. Maybe
right, so.
So
we have to decide whether the prejudgment interest is damages regardless of uninsured or underinsured and apply to be consistent, do we not?
Perhaps. Good question. May I respond further
yes.
to that?
Yes.
There's a lot of case law that talks about prejudgment interest as being interest eo nomine, whatever that means, or interest as damages. There's some old cases that say it's punitive because you've taken someone else's money and used it. There is recent cases, ever since Kavanaugh, I believe, that essentially state that it's compensation for the loss of use of money. And so if you are to include it in damages, to me it'd be in that context. It's not defined in the policy. Now, in my case, which is an underinsured motorist case, there is no loss of use of money. How in the world can you award it? They've deemed to have received it.
Well, yeah, we understand that. We're trying to reconcile underinsured and uninsured, which in your case is only underinsured. We
yes.
understand that.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The call is submitted and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.